This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. No matter where you are or what you're doing right now, I'm going to ask you to just stop. Stop and take a deep breath. Ready? Feels good, right? At least I hope it feels good. We take breathing for granted. In fact, it's rare that we even stop and think about it before we do it. But what is in the air we breathe? The molecules that tag along with the oxygen we desperately need are tainted by pollutants from our homes, our factories, and our cars. And it seems we're seeing more extreme pollution situations in big cities like London, places where it's very hard to breathe, places where dust from the Sahara is settling on cars.
They've combined with particles that have blown over from Europe. And air pollution levels in the UK have been particularly bad. For some of us, that's meant sore throats and sore eyes. But for those who have lung and heart problems, they've been asked to take particular care.
Meanwhile, across the English Channel,
it's a good time to have a hybrid in Paris. Otherwise, hundreds of police are pulling cars over trying to battle a smoggy situation. It's the most dramatic intervention since 1997, when authorities tried to reduce health-threatening pollution. Cars with even-numbered plates were told to stay home.
Today we're looking at the air we breathe. How clean is our air? What can we do to improve our air quality? You can join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can also email us wherelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherelive. You can always follow along on our website, WNPR.org. Before we welcome in our guests, we want to welcome in some special guests who are here to take part in our conversation today. Den 8, Pac 27, they're Cub Scouts from the town of Durham. Give yourselves a hand, guys, for getting up so early. Thank you for coming in. It's not often we have Cub Scouts here on the program, so we're glad to have them. We're also glad to have Ann Gobin, who's a Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's Bureau of Air Management. Ann, good to see you. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, John.
Obviously, this is a big topic, and we're going to get lots of phone calls and bring in some other people into the conversation. But one of the things we read is that in 2012, statistics that we have most recently, Connecticut had the worst air quality in New England, and it surpassed the EPA's mandated ozone restrictions. I guess I'm wondering, how good is our air here in our state?
We've made a lot of progress over the last 30 years. We used to see much worse air quality, especially on hot summer days. But 2013 was a tough year for us. We actually saw levels as high as 136 parts per billion of ozone, which we haven't seen in the past 10 years.
When you say 136 parts per billion of ozone, give us some sense of the limits on that. What does that mean exactly?
The current standard that EPA has deemed safe and appropriate under the National Ambient Air Quality Standards is an 84 part per billion standard. Well, it was an 84. It had then in 2008 became a 75 part per billion standard. And at the time they were working on it, the health professionals indicated to truly be safe, they recommended the standard be in the 60 to 70 part per billion range.
So from your standpoint, why has our air gotten to that level? Why isn't it cleaner?
I think we've seen this uptick for two reasons. One of them being our air quality is very is the result of transported pollution and weather patterns. So if you have the right weather pattern set up and you're getting upper level airflow from the Midwest and airflow coming in up the coast from the south along the Atlantic, we get the worst of the mass of the population along the East Coast and the emissions they generate. And we get the emissions from the power that is being generated in the Midwest, where they're very tall stacks and the plants aren't required to meet the same standards as our power plants.
So we're essentially importing bad air from other places in the country that maybe aren't as concerned about the air quality as we are.
That, and then it tends to be on very hot days in the summer, and we all turn on our air conditioning, and that generates peak load on our electric generation system, and it requires calling up electric generation units that are old and dirty.
There's a number of issues. Well, we're going to get to that in just a moment. I want to bring in Dave Conroy, who's Air Division Director for the EPA's New England office. He joins us on the phone from Boston today. David, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, John.
So you heard Ann spell that out a little bit. Is that what you see as the problem in the Northeast, that essentially we're getting the product of the bad air that's coming from the Midwest, from the South in the United States?
Yeah, we continue to have what we deem is unacceptable levels of air pollution, especially in southern New England, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And the phenomenon of transport is a well-documented phenomenon. EPA is doing a number of things to try to address transport. One of the things we've been doing is addressing pollution from cars and trucks, and we've put in place a number of tight standards. Just recently, we adopted even tighter standards for automobiles and light-duty trucks. So starting in 2017, the standards on vehicles are going to be increasingly tighter, and that should provide benefits in the future. And then we have been addressing power plants for a number of years. There's still more to be done, but we've made tremendous progress in reducing pollution from power plants, seeing significant reductions in the pollutants that cause ground-level ozone or smog. But there's certainly more to be done, and certainly more to be done on the peak ozone days where, as Ann said, power generation is sort of all out running, and we have some of the older units that come on those days, and those certainly need to be addressed in the future.
We're going to be talking about air quality in the program today, including health impacts. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. I'm wondering, Dave, if you can maybe put some sort of percentages on it for us. How much of the dirty air, the ozone that we don't want, comes from cars and trucks? How much comes from those power plants? Are we tackling the right sources of the pollution, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, in general, the pollution from cars and trucks generally is about 50% or so. And as I said, we've made tremendous progress reducing pollution from those sources. It varies by area of the country, but pollution from power plants can be upwards of a third of the pollution, 25% to a third of the pollution. And it depends on the pollutant, but on high ozone days, we're certainly seeing contribution from power plants. We've seen progress, but certainly more needs to be done.
I'm wondering, Ann, if you might address that a little bit. When we think about our own causes of pollution here in the Northeast, how much of it really comes down to the cars and trucks we drive, the way we drive on our roads today, and how much do you put toward the problem of power plants?
As far as the mobile source contribution, the cars and the trucks, about 40% of the nitrogen oxides, which are the key pollutant that combines with volatile organics in time and with heat to make ozone. So about 40% is coming from mobile sources.
40% coming from mobile sources. Is it much harder from a lawmaking standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, to cut down on that number, or is it easier to cut down on the overall ozone creating contaminants in the air when they're coming from specific sources, like a power plant?
From a cost per ton and identifying the problem and administrative kind of perspective, getting the most cost-effective reductions from the power plants has always been something on the plate, on the table, that we've been working toward, and big reductions have been achieved. As we look at the Connecticut power plants, there's less and less that can be done because getting the last ton out gets more and more expensive.
Getting the last ton out gets more expensive. Explain what you mean.
You start with various levels of control. So you might start at a low NOx burner. And then you would look at a lower level of NOx control. And as you push the envelope, you can only get so clean. And each level of technology you apply becomes more expensive. And the power plants are running less and less. So what we find is our old dirty power plants are running many fewer days. So if we look at the total tons they emit, and divide that by the cost, it becomes a very high number They also are nearing the end of their useful productive life, and they are less efficient. So when we are thinking about greenhouse gases and where we invest for the future, you may have heard about the governor's energy strategy, where he's very focused on getting the cheapest, cleanest, most reliable energy, moving us all toward natural gas, which is a good thing. We have the nuclear power plant, which has no air emissions from an air pollution perspective. But we need to keep looking at new clean technologies, and the energy world is driving us to look at things like solar and wind, which, again, have no emissions. So as we look at renewables, we look at the mix of how we meet our generation portfolio. The future is very important in the energy decisions to getting us to clean air and to addressing global climate change.
We're talking about air quality in Connecticut and globally today on the program. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We're talking about, of course, the future of air quality as well. We have with us a group of people who care about that quite a bit, I would assume. They are Den 8, Pac 27 of the Durham Cub Scouts. So they're here watching our show. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let's go to the phones here. Peter's calling from Cheshire. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question and a comment. My comment is, last July, coming home from New Jersey, I was on the Garden State Parkway. To the right of me was New York City. Above New York City was this yellow, mustard-colored-looking cloud across the whole city. And I know that it was maybe 90 degrees that day or something that had something to do with it. But that is a very, very troubling scene. And that air, I'm assuming, goes towards Connecticut. So New York's got to take a step there and do something about that. But also, my question is, on any given day, you can go outside and look up in the skies and see these trails that the planes are leaving behind. What is going on with that? I would like to know. Not many questions are being answered on that. And it's not every day that that happens, because there's days where you can look up in the sky and not see a single trail, and I know there's planes up there. And a normal contrail, it does not look like that. So I would like more information on that.
Well, and thank you very much, Dave. So let's answer the two questions. We'll answer the second question first. He looks up in the sky. He sees the plane contrails. Are they polluting the air that we're breathing?
That's mainly water vapor. Those have been studied quite a bit. You know, planes do emit nitrogen oxides. There are some air pollution standards for aircraft, but it takes a long, long time to phase those in. I guess to the question of New York City, you know, what you do see is pollution. It's a combination of the nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, that haze in the air is pollution that, you know, when the wind blows towards New England, does come into New England. A big component of that is the diesel emissions, and EPA has been working on diesel emissions. And to get to the question of, you know, is it more difficult to control those vehicles, EPA has put in place tough standards, and it does take some time for those standards to take effect as the newer vehicles, which are required to meet the standards, replace the older vehicles. That's where you get your air quality benefit. But for a diesel vehicle, that can take, you know, upwards of 20 years. For a brand new, you know, for passenger vehicles, that can take, you know, 10 to 12 years before you get the new fleet replacing the old fleet.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Angel Hsu, who's director of the Environmental Performance Measurement Program at Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. We're also going to take some more of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266, finding out what's in the air we breathe, how good the quality of our air is here, not only in Connecticut, but globally as well. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the air we breathe, about air quality here in Connecticut and around the world. We just had a caller talk about a mustard-colored haze on a hot day over New York City. Those sorts of hazes have been falling on cities like Paris and London, Beijing, and various cities are trying various methods to try to get rid of that problem. We're taking a look at air quality in the program. You can join us, 860-275-7266. I want to bring into the conversation from the Yale University Studios in New Haven, Dr. Angel Hsu, who's director of the Environmental Performance Measurement Program at the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. Welcome, Dr. Hsu, to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, John.
First of all, how bad is our air in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world?
Well, that's a really great question. The project that I manage here at Yale is called the Environmental Performance Index, and it's a biannual ranking of how well countries perform on critical environmental issues, including air quality. So the United States, relatively speaking to some other parts of the world, namely South Asia, is doing okay, is not doing as poorly. So in the latest version of the EPI that was released in January, what we found is that, unsurprisingly perhaps, China has the world's worst air quality. But then there are other countries, including India and other countries in South Asia, that had equally bad air quality and very shocking results in our study.
Now, we're going to be talking about China in just a moment, and that's a story that, of course, we've heard and we've seen. We saw the terrible problems in Beijing a few years ago. But when you see this happening in cities like London and Paris, big European cities where they've had to change traffic patterns to try to deal with massive problems of pollution, what does that say to you? Is something, Dr. Hsu, changing about the way we pollute or the way we monitor that is brand new to us here? Because I wasn't used to seeing, Paris covered in smog.
I think the key lesson is that air quality is a global problem. It's not just a problem that affects rapidly industrializing, urbanizing countries in the developing world. It's a problem that in the United States we still tackle. So, for example, last summer in Salt Lake City, there were very severe levels of air pollution. We're seeing a couple weeks ago, Paris, they were offering free public transportation to try to encourage citizens to not drive their vehicles. So I think that the lesson here is that it's a global problem, it's transboundary, and that everyone needs to tackle it, needs to work on it.
And being that it's transboundary, it gets to some of the questions that we were talking about with folks from the DEEP and the EPA here. It's that when, pollution goes up in the air in the Midwest, it floats over the northeast part of this United States. If you pollute in Europe, it's going to pollute someplace else. How do you think we best deal with this, Doctor? Because, again, it covers across boundaries. It's very difficult to get at, and everyone's going to have different standards, aren't they?
Exactly. So South Korea, for example, was quite surprised that they were amongst the bottom performers on our air quality indicators in the 2014 EPI. And so they contacted us and said, well, we don't feel like your measurement system is very fair and the indicators are not very fair because we suffer from transboundary pollution coming in from China. And so I think the lesson here is that countries have to work together. Regions have to work together and cooperate to try to tackle common sources of pollution. And so Seoul, for example, initiated talks with Beijing to try to figure out how the two capital cities can work together to address air pollution from common sources.
Let's go quickly to the phones. Peter's in Cheshire. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. Oh, sorry. Peter is gone. Let's just go quickly to John in Kensington. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just calling in to say in 1974, when I was a senior in high school, I did an experiment where I cut up nylon. And in the laboratory, I had little squares of it. I took different levels of acid. I mixed it in with the water and had different pHs and sprayed it on the different squares to see how the acid would change the nylon. And I put another group up on the roof of the high school.
Okay.
And for a month I monitored. Nothing happened. I was so disappointed. My experiment was going to be a failure. There was no acid rain. And then one weekend we had a rainstorm that blew in from the Midwest, and all the nylons on the roof turned red. And I was able to chart what that pH of that water was. And, of course, I was thrilled. My professor was so disappointed that we had an acid rain experiment. But it's real, and it was very easy for me to evaluate and chart.
Well, this is interesting. So a little science experiment on the roof there. You're nodding your head, Anne.
I was thinking that you demonstrated very nicely that transport is a big problem for us. A lot has gone on to reduce acid rain with sulfur dioxide controls and sulfur controls, but and Connecticut has less of a problem in that our soils absorb it better than they do in upstate New York. But in upstate New York, they do have major problems still with acid rain.
It's interesting. We had a conversation with an early pioneer in the environmental movement about acid rain and the way that terminology actually worked to get people thinking more about it. And it seems as though the language that we use is very important. David Conroy from the EPA, I'm wondering if you might weigh in on this. I mean, the way we talk about pollution, I think, can either help to get people very interested in solving the problem, or it can be another one of these things that they can just sit back and go, there's not that much I can do about it. Do you think there's something to the way we talk about pollution today?
Yeah, back 20 years ago, acid rain was a well-known phenomenon, and under the Clean Air Act of 1990, it was something that was addressed, and we've seen progress on that. As we've, turned our attention to different air pollutants, we do need to make sure that, people are aware of those pollutants, aware of what they need to do when pollutants in the air are high. So we have, a website that has sort of real-time information of air pollutants. You can get that information via, Twitter and a variety of mechanisms. And we try to get the message out there, but it is important for people to be aware of what's in the air they breathe.
And, of course, Dr. Hsu, I think one of the other things that might get people more interested in this is just the health impacts. Maybe we can just talk through that a little bit. When we hear about ozone, bad air pollution day, we might hear on the news, it's you should stay in if you have asthma or lung problems. But if we just start to lay out some of the real health impacts of bad air quality in our cities and really across our state, I think people might start to pay a little bit more attention, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not an environmental health expert, but for example, one of the issues that we study through the EPI, the Environmental Performance Index, is fine particulate matter. So these are invisible toxic particles that can penetrate human lung and blood tissue and lead to cardiovascular disease, lung cancer, and we see in many parts of the world, including the United States, people who have asthma, who might be sensitive to air pollution, should stay indoors when air pollution levels are high, and particularly for fine particulate matter when it can be quite severe.
I want to go to a quick phone call in Bloomfield. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I wanted to advocate for a statewide conversion of intersections from stoplights to roundabouts. There's a lot of benefits for roundabouts over stoplights in many ways. Studies have shown that they're safer because people aren't racing to fly through the yellow light, beat the red. It's less stressful because you don't sit and just have to stop every 20 minutes at an intersection. But for the air pollution discussion, think of the number of times you're just sitting and idling, thousands of cars across the state, even if there's no traffic coming from the other direction. And by having traffic move continuously, commute times would be shortened, and you would eliminate really thousands and thousands of cars just sitting and idling at intersections waiting for the lights to turn green.
Mike, thank you very much for that. I'm wondering, Dave Conroy, if that's something that states are looking at a lot. If we're talking about what's causing air pollution in our cities, it's not just a lot of cars driving. It's a lot of cars sitting at stoplights idling.
Yeah, I mean, back 30 years ago, that is part of the genesis of the right turn on red was an air pollution control measure. I guess with regard to idling, that that continues to be a problem both for the big diesel vehicles as well as for automobiles to some extent. The standards for air pollutants as well as for fuel economy are actually pushing to new technologies that minimize that idling or minimize the emissions during idling, like a hybrid. When you're at an intersection with a hybrid, the engine is not running. So that's sort of one way to address that problem in the future.
I wanted, before we get to another phone call, I wanted to ask Dr. Hsu about some of the ideas that have been put in place in cities like London or Paris that we've seen recently where air pollution has gotten so bad that they've tried to curtail people driving on certain days. We've read some reports that say that type of control doesn't necessarily work. People will just get a couple cars with different plates, and sometimes they're dirtier cars than the ones that they were driving before. What do you think about traffic control in big cities as a way to cut down on smog and pollution?
John, I think that's absolutely essential. So actually congestion pricing, so this is charging vehicles within London who try to drive in the city center, the downtown areas, during peak congestion and traffic times, a surcharge for coming into the city, have actually been effective in reducing cars on the road and also air pollution. So I think some of these examples of gaming the system, getting different license plates, that's definitely a challenge. And we see that happening in China, in major cities like Beijing, for example, who instituted these odd-even license plate rules after the Olympics and before and after the Olympics. And so, I mean, I think it's a challenge, but they have shown to be effective in some cases. And I think that's what's absolutely needed.
I want to bring into our conversation Christopher James, who's a principal with a regulatory assistance project. He's based in Tacoma, Washington. And Chris joins us on the phone right now. Chris, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, John. My pleasure. And as a former New Hartford resident, it's good to hear your voice.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, New Hartford out in my neck of the woods. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing researching Chinese air quality?
Sure. Well, the thing with China, I think, is just to understand the context. There are only, I would say, two American cities that are of any size that are equivalent to Chinese cities, New York and Los Angeles. So the city that I live near, Seattle, at 4 million, would be considered a small Chinese city. And added to that is the 7% per year growth in GDP. So what we see is a very rapid, economic development and industrialization, development of the middle class, and pollution levels throughout China that are hazardous. I would say, though, that compared to London and 1950s and Los Angeles in the 60s, despite what people see on the media, pollution levels in Beijing are actually lower than what those cities experience. But the difference is that we're much smarter now. When we breathe, your lungs do not say, geez, I'm breathing a little bit of ozone, or I'm breathing a little bit of mercury, or I'm breathing a little bit of fine particulate. You're experiencing the cumulative effects of all those particles at the same time. And that is, in fact, the approach that China is taking now to resolving its air quality issues, to not look at the single pollutant basis like we did in the United States, first looking at soot in the 60s and acid rain in the 70s and 80s and then mercury in the 90s and so forth, but to jointly look at all of these pollutants together as well as ways to use energy more efficiently so that we're also stopping and slowing the rate of greenhouse gas reductions.
You seem to be suggesting that the United States could learn something from the way the Chinese are studying this problem?
Absolutely. What we call a multi-pollutant approach, which is, in fact, what is being required now throughout the 113 key cities in China and then the 338 prefecture-level cities. It would basically be like President Obama saying to all the mayors of the United States, of all the major cities, you must develop multi-pollutant plans that by the end of 2017 improve ambient air quality 25%. And if you don't, you won't get promoted. You might get transferred to a less desirable post. Or if you're really underperforming, you may lose your job.
So this is maybe that's a little bit different than the way the United States federal government works. But, I mean, so as to not put too sunny a face on this, Christopher, I mean, the reason that they had to deal with this is because of the, rapid, unchecked growth of industry in China that led to these problems in the first place. Essentially, there weren't a whole lot of regulations when all these power plants and all these cities were spiraling out of control.
There's a few things. First, John, yes, I mean, absolutely rapid steel production and cement and iron and so forth has, without controls has been a huge problem. And that's something that is also being done. But my point about what the U.S. can learn was not so much on the performance side, but the fact that the approach has been one to compel joint action to reduce multiple pollutants at the same time. And when you look at it that way, you really get into the structure of, okay, well, why is pollution what's causing this pollution, what's driving it. And in most cases, it gets to the energy use. And, you know, as Ann pointed out, Connecticut is now looking at renewables as a way to improve air quality. We see that in China with this huge growth of wind and solar. But equally important to us is the how energy is consumed. You know, the average coal plant is about 33% thermally efficient in the United States. So that means two-thirds of that fuel is wasted. So how can we use this energy more efficiently? And when we look at it that way, we see highly cost-effective solutions that not only reduce air pollution, but also can improve water quality and land use.
I wonder if I can bring in Dr. Hsu very quickly to comment a bit on what Christopher had to say and maybe some lessons that we can learn from the rest of the world, places where they've had clearly some problems with air quality, but maybe they're solving some of these problems in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that China is rapidly developing and facing a lot of these critical challenges. And I mean, I think that the cooperation between the United States and China on air pollution is actually a shining spot. So the U.S. EPA and the Chinese Ministry of Environmental Protection over the last decade have sent experts from both countries to the respective capitals to have forums and technology exchange and learning from each other on how to tackle air pollution. So I think actually that's a good example of countries working together to make improvements and investments in monitoring and methods and to work together to tackle air pollution.
I also wonder if I can get a quick comment from David Conroy about this. When Christopher's laying out the Chinese method of trying to crack down on air pollution problems, it sounds like, let's just say, a little bit more of a top-down way of managing air pollution than the federal government has ever gotten into. What do you say to the Chinese way of going about things?
Yeah, I guess I'm not that familiar with it, but I guess a big difference here is, you know, the states under the Clean Air Act have rigorous permitting regulations. So any new facilities constructed over the last, you know, 20 to 25 years are generally very well controlled, and it's not the new facilities here in the United States that, you know, continue to cause the biggest air pollution problems. We are, you know, EPA is working on greenhouse gas regulations for power plants, which we will be announcing in June. And through those regulations, we, you know, we do look to allow a lot of flexibility in terms of how to meet pollutant standards through things like energy efficiency, renewable energy. That's the expectation. So we are kind of going in that direction, I think.
As David says, it's not the new plants that we have to worry about. And you mentioned earlier, it's the older plants, the older style plants, many of which are in the Midwest, that we really have to deal with. How many of those older style coal burning plants do we have here in Connecticut, and how big a problem are they?
Well, in Connecticut, we have one remaining coal burning plant. It is relatively clean. Our dirtiest in pounds of NOx per megawatt hour units are old jet engines used to meet peak day demands that, when they're burning oil, are very dirty. And we have a number of old oil plants that are very inefficient and were never designed to be peaking units. They were designed to be baseload units in their day and to meet the energy demand at times on a hot summer day, which is the very worst time to have them run. They can be called up. At times, we've worried that in an emergency, all the diesel and emergency engines that exist out unregulated could be called upon. Luckily, that's not happening, and we're meeting our power needs with better than emergency engines, but there still are the old units in Connecticut. They are slowly dying away with, as the energy world becomes more competitive, cost competitive. And but there are days when, say, a major source of megawatts is down, and these things can kick on.
So just so that everyone understands in the listening audience, what you're saying is, on the days when it's the absolute worst to be burning dirty fuel, we have dirty, inefficient plants that fire up in order to meet peak demand.
That can happen, yes. That is the concern.
And what are we doing to phase that out, you say, as the energy world gets more competitive? I mean, could we just stop tomorrow and say, look, we're going to build some new plants. We're going to fire off peak demand off of some other type of fuel source. We're making this major investment in, say, natural gas. Can we do it that way?
We can do it that way, but I think we are looking at what's best for the consumer, too, and balancing cost to the consumer with air quality. And the way the energy strategy is looking at it is, instead of just shutting them down and building new, we're looking at what we can do to reduce that peak demand. So there's a wait till 8 campaign. There's initiatives to
wait till 8 to do what?
To use appliances at home. There are programs where industry gets preferential rates if they shut down on days of very high demand. So if we can reduce that peak, we never have to turn these plants on, and then we don't have to spend the money in new generation.
Before we take a break, I just want to quickly ask for a comment maybe from Christopher James, this idea of behavior modification on the consumer level or maybe industry incentives on the industry level. I mean, how much do you think things like that work globally? Do you think that they can really work to reduce pollution here in Connecticut?
I would just, John, point out that Connecticut and New England have probably one of the best what's called a demand response or load management programs in the United States through the independent system operator for New England, which manages the grid. I sat on the Connecticut's efficiency board for a number of years, and it was highly effective in pulling together a group of non-emitting resources, energy efficiency among them, that could participate during these peak periods that Anne has been describing. Because in addition to the emissions, the other problem is these are very expensive resources to use. So the consumer, as well as utilities, pay a lot of money for those hours. So reducing even for a few hours is highly effective from a cost perspective as well as from emissions. Globally, it's, you know, that question is a mixed answer because, you know, in some places, you know, outside of developed areas in eastern China, as well as throughout India, you don't have a reliable electric supply to begin with. So you first, you know, have the basic issue of, you know, actually providing comfort and lighting, which doesn't exist in a lot of those places. But the other question, though, in like the demand response, can be effective in Western Europe. And on the industrial behavior side, we do see that in China, where the power plants, iron and steel industry, and so forth, are being required to improve their processes, meaning not only install back-end emission controls like we have in the United States, but also look at, you know, how are they actually making cement, how are they actually making steel, et cetera, to make sure that the processes themselves are consuming the least possible fuel.
Mm. We're talking with Christopher James, who's principal with the Regulatory Assistance Project. He's based in Tacoma, Washington. Also on the line with us is David Conroy, who's the Air Division Director for EPA's New England office. He's based in Boston. From New Haven, we have Dr. Angel Hsu, who's Director of the Environmental Performance Measurement Program at Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. And Ann Gobin joins us here in studio. She's Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection's Bureau of Air Management. We're talking about the air we breathe. We're going to take some more of your calls at 860-275-7266 right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about a few subjects that are in the news this week, including a new study from the University of Connecticut that takes a look at parking in our cities, places like Hartford and New Haven. People always say there's not enough parking. Actually, there's so much parking that it might be causing a problem for those cities. We'll find out a little bit more coming up on tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking about air quality in Connecticut and in the U.S. and around the globe. And we're talking with you at 860-275-7266. Let's go to Achilles, who's calling from Simsbury. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having this program on a public health issue that's crucial to all of us. I have a comment. When people hear about this matter, very often they can push it aside because they don't want to believe data. The American Heart Association sponsors many journals, one of which is called Circulation. It deals with clinical research. And in 2013, a group from Baylor University School of Medicine and Rice University in Houston published a paper titled, short version, Analysis of Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest and Air Pollution. The city that they focused on was where they live, Houston. And if you read the paper and reach their conclusion, the conclusion is the findings that they obtained, which were taken between 2004 and 2011 for the city of Houston, confirm a link between out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and fine particulate matter, and they introduce evidence of a similar link with ozone. I encourage folks who want to get beyond the matter of anecdotes about what happens when we have air pollution to read this paper. It's in the volume 127, page 1192 and so on, 2013. It deals with an American city and Americans who are dying from the effects of particulate matter in the air.
Well, first of all, Achilles, thank you very much for drawing our attention to that paper and for getting our conversation in this direction as well. And David Conroy, quickly, I'm wondering, we might want to listen for a moment to an EPA-based ad that you've put out actually telling people about this very thing that Achilles was just talking about. Let's listen.
If you have heart disease, be smart and protect yourself from air pollution. Air pollution can trigger heart attacks, strokes, and make existing heart conditions worse. Check the daily air quality forecast, which is color-coded. Code orange or higher can be harmful to your heart. So on these days, reschedule outdoor activities or work out indoors and exercise away from busy roads. Be smart. Protect your heart. Learn more at epa.gov/healthyheart.
Dave, as we listen to that ad coming out from the EPA, what else can you tell us about the links to heart disease and air pollution?
Well, those are well-documented health effects from air pollution, especially fine particles. And those are the types of studies that we take into account when we set air quality standards. We just recently revised the standard for fine particles in 2012, and we're currently analyzing which areas across the country are not meeting those standards and which areas across the country will have to develop plans if they're out of compliance with those standards. And as we speak, we're in the process of reevaluating the ozone standard. There was a meeting last week of the Clean Air Act Scientific Advisory Committee looking at EPA's health effects studies and our report, and we'll be moving forward with a proposal probably later this year with our findings on whether the current ozone standard is adequate. So we take into account all that health information, and then as your ad played, that information is readily available real-time on the website. We collect the real-time data from the state monitors across the country and display that in what we think is an easily understandable format, which allows people to take action when air pollution levels are high.
I want to thank our guest, David Conroy, who's Air Division Director for EPA's New England office based in Boston. David, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before we conclude our conversation, I know one of the things that we wanted to get to, Dr. Angel Hsu, is whether or not we should really be relying just on the government to be monitoring our air quality, or whether or not there's something that citizens can do, more that we can do ourselves. What do you say?
Yeah, I mentioned the data gaps that we've experienced in developing our indicators. And what we argue is that governments, they have different financial resources, capacities to measure air pollution, and also different political motivations and will to provide transparent information and data on air pollution. And so what we're now encouraging is that I think there needs to be more investments in low-cost air monitoring technology so that citizens can then arm themselves with the with these monitors to monitor air pollution themselves, particularly in countries where governments don't provide regular real-time measurements of air pollution.
What do you think about this, Christopher James? In your work in China, is this something that can work? More people just out there with air quality monitors helping to get us data?
Yeah, this what's called crowdsourced air pollution monitoring is a significant issue, and it's one that can benefit government quite well. As Dr. Hsu mentioned, individual monitors are quite expensive and fixed. They need to be in the same place. So to augment that, citizens have taken on their own, not only in Asia, but in the United States and in Eastern Europe. These monitors cost anywhere from $200 to $600. They can be as small as an iPhone or this device that's called the Copenhagen Wheel that was developed by MIT that actually is something you can put on, basically as it sounds, on a bicycle and go around. And these, you know, more granular, as I would say, in other words, more dense data can really help to not only pinpoint sources of the pollution, but also the effectiveness of regulations that are adopted for industrial sources as well as transportation. But it is important that government get ahead of this because, you know, we are seeing things called bucket brigades in Southeast Asia where citizens are taking their own initiative to monitor air. And unless government gets ahead of this, you do have a possibility where there's not only mistrust, but also, you know, this could create some, you know, political types of issues.
Christopher James, principal with the Regulatory Assistance Project. He's based in Tacoma, Washington. He's been studying air quality in China. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. You're very welcome.
And before we run low on time, I just wanted to go to Ann Gobin. I know you wanted to jump in on this part of the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting area. These personal monitors are going to become mainstream. We've seen in Connecticut where monitoring done by citizens has really helped move us forward to address problems. In New Haven, a group of citizens went out and monitored the pollution from diesel buses and showed that that was a problem. And the result of that was the legislature appropriating $10 million to put controls on existing diesel buses, and we have a much cleaner school bus fleet because of that.
And so good things
happen when citizens are proactive.
Well, and before we run low on time, I think that's what's so important about this, Ann, is that we've talked a lot about imported pollution, pollution coming from other parts of the world, and we have to worry about that. But what you're saying is these are citizens that are looking at what are the causes right there in our backyard that very well could be causing our kids to be sick.
Yes, and it's very important. There are things out there. The design of the monitoring networks we have as states are really in, I will say, neighborhood scale. We have 10 ozone monitors, about 10 PM monitors, particulate matter monitors across Connecticut. What we're looking at is the broad area. In general, what are people breathing? But the localized point we may be missing.
Well, if you want to get more information on this, I'm sure that you can get in touch with folks at the DEEP. Ann Gobin is Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protections, Bureau of Air Management. Ann, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to Dr. Angel Hsu, who's Director of the Environmental Performance Measurement Program at Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. We'll put some of their information on our website, WNPR.org. Thank you, Dr. Hsu. Thanks to the Cub Scouts who joined us today. And thanks to you for listening to Where We Live.